From Migration Media, this is Migratory Patterns. I'm your host, Mike Shaw. It'd be tough to find someone who has had a more successful migration story than P.T. Black, but it's also one that you would not really expect. He grew up in a famous Boston neighborhood, was able to get into top schools, and then launch a career in international business in New York. But after watching the second plane fly into the World Trade Center from his apartment in Brooklyn, he felt like he needed to choose an alternate path. He landed in Shanghai just a few months later. Now, after a career in market research and development that has had him at the forefront of China's historic transformation into a modern world-leading economy, he finds himself reflecting on how he's changed from the, quote, China guy to the guy who knows China, and whether there's a way to ever go home again. When he talked about transitioning from the, quote, China guy to something else, that really hit home for me. I spoke with a friend recently and told her what I've been talking about on this podcast for the last few months. Namely, that my wife and I are thinking about our future as expats, and whether we'll be staying in Beijing for another couple of years, or if she'll take a job in another country. When I mentioned this possible move, my friend said that she wouldn't know what to call me anymore. To her husband and daughter, who was actually born after I left my hometown, I've always been referred to as China Mike. What else could they possibly call me? What else indeed? This was a perspective-altering discussion for me. As you'll hear, PT showed me a different way of thinking about the migration experience. Not only was the start of his journey one that I hadn't thought about before, but he's also the first person I've spoken with who has spent an entire career overseas and is now actively thinking about how it might come to an end. It's given me lots of food for thought, and I'm eager to share what we talked about. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with PT Black. P.T. Black, welcome to Migratory Patterns.
Thanks, good to be here.
Where is home?
What a good question. Home for me is, my mom hears this, Shanghai. It's Shanghai, China.
Your mom wouldn't be proud that you've evolved?
As long as it's not New York, she's happy. I won't lie to you. I'm originally from Boston, and she got very angry when I moved to New York after college.
Oh, really?
When I moved to Shanghai, she said, okay, at least you're on the way back. You're coming home.
I like that a lot. So let's kind of run through how you got from there to here. So you said you're from Boston. Where in Boston?
I grew up in the middle of the city, in downtown Boston.
Downtown.
Yeah.
So I'm from Dorchester.
Yes, a dot rat.
I'm a dot rat through and through. So where, what neighborhood was it?
I grew up on Beacon Hill.
You grew up on Beacon Hill?
I grew up on Beacon Hill.
Oh, we used to beat the crap out of people like you from my neighborhood.
I know. I am very aware of that. Yeah.
That's pretty awesome. So, were your relatives Heinzes or?
No. It's actually funny. My last name is Black. And so I grew up in Beacon Hill. We moved a couple blocks, and the joke was the Blacks moved next door, and everyone got really worried. And I was like, this is really like Boston. Come on, get it together.
And this is like 70s, 80s Boston.
Yeah, exactly.
This is when it was quite ugly.
Yeah, it was like that. No, my father's a doctor.
Okay.
And so actually, when he was training, it's near to
Mass General. Is it Mass General?
Yeah, he was, and he moved. But that's the neighborhood we grew up in.
Cool. So how did a nice guy from Beacon Hill end up in Shanghai? What was the path?
It started off at Boston Latin School.
Oh, there you go.
Yes, I'm an old school, America's oldest high school, in case you missed the chance to say
oldest public school. John Adams is a big alum. Yeah,
exactly. We got all the people.
Yeah.
So I went to Boston Latin School, and in 1991, I was given the chance to choose a foreign language. So it was, you know, French, Spanish, Italian, German, or Chinese. And we had mandatory Latin, and I hated it. I hated it so much. I hated declensions. I hated conjugations. I hated having to gender things. And so I jumped at the chance for what has none of those things. And the Chinese teacher, which was brand new, she said, we don't have conjugations. We don't have tenses. I said, perfect. It'll be so easy. So I started studying Chinese back in the 90s. And then it seemed eventually I was going to end up here.
Wow. So did you take it all 4 years while you're in Latin?
4 years of Boston Latin, and then in college, I did a degree in East Asian Studies.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Yale.
Oh.
I know. Well, here we go again. You beat me up there, too.
No. No. Actually, well, I'll tell you a little story. So I went to Boston College High School, which is
it's of the same ilk of Bossolet. Bossolet, of course, is older. It's more probably well known. But BC High is was Catholic school, private school, run by the Jesuits, who are the hippies of Catholicism, and they've been doing education since the 1600s, and a very elite college prep school. I was the village idiot because I scored under 1200 on my SATs in my senior class. I was one of the handful of people that, you know.
Oh my goodness. I'm going to gather my things and leave.
This I know.
You're going to lower my average.
Yeah. So, I'm very used to people in my cohort. I've gone to Yale and Harvard and Princeton and Brown and all these, you know, and I went to Suffolk University, which is fine school. But
and actually, on the way up, it seems every time I go home, there's a new Suffolk University building on Beacon Hill.
Here's the thing. This is a little bit off track, but what I've learned later in life is that once you get out of school, and especially if you move overseas or move anywhere outside your home, no one gives a crap what school you went to.
You know, except for my mother. She constantly asks people, and look at her, like she's an absolute crazy person. Like, who cares? But she's just trying to figure out the world. That's how she navigates the world. And my parents are, they're academics. So it's kind of how they connect. But yeah, it doesn't matter at all. I do think that the colors you wear matter because you carry those with you. When I see blue, I get excited. And I see red and crimson, I couldn't really bother.
I actually had this moment. I was, this was sometime in the aughts before I even thought I would move to China. I was active in local politics and I went to this forum on urban planning and streets and things, and it was being held at the Kennedy School. And I had asked some questions and got into a little bit of a debate. I'm a bit of a urban planning nerd, transportation nerd. And I got into a little bit of a debate with the facilitator. He'd written this book and it was like all the big brains were there. And it's not like I had some profound thing I had to say, but it was, I kind of held my own. And as we were leaving, this guy got in the elevator with me and he looks at me, and goes, "Do you go to Harvard?" I guess he was trying to place me, like, who is this guy and where is he from? He's like, "Did you go to Harvard?" And just knee jerk reaction, I went, "No." I was insulted that you would, like, why would I go to some stupid place like Harvard? Like, stuck up. I was totally working class Dorchester, like the other side of the river. F you.
Well, it's funny because I get here all the time. People want to make fun of me, and it's hard because they make fun of me. Like, "Oh, you're that Harvard kid." I'm like, how do you take that? Because on the one hand, normally you'd say, "Yeah, leave it alone." But they're like, "No, but I went to Yale." And it's annoying. Like, it annoys me. So I always end up pushing back. And like, "Oh, that's what you're not supposed to do."
That's right.
Like, just take it.
You're one of those.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, but I'm a different one of those. But yeah, say it's the same thing. Yeah.
So you went to Yale, East Asian Studies, and then was it like right after Yale, you're like, "Well, East Asian Studies, I got to go to China"?
You know, the actual truth is I moved to New York, and actually it's a funny story about being a Bostonian and moving into New York in the year 2000. I moved into a building in Brooklyn, and the Italian woman in the building said, before I took the apartment, she said, "One question, Yankees or Mets?"
Oh, wow.
And I was like, this is a dangerous question. I'm going to lose the apartment, first of all. No question. I can't get it right. And I said, "I'll be honest with you, ma'am. I'm from Boston. I hate the Yankees and I've never heard of the Mets." And she started laughing. I said, "Good, because we're totally equal in this household. We can't add anyone on either side. You passed." And
I was like, "Wow."
So I was in New York. I worked in New York. And then this was 2000. And then there was a little bit of a public safety issue in September of 2001, a little bit of drama downtown. And I looked at the second plane flying in and thought, I speak Chinese. This would be a perfect time to not be sitting in New York City. Yeah. And I moved. And I said to myself, I'll go back to America when everything gets back to normal.
And you've been waiting.
It's 18 years. Yeah. It's 17 years.
Actually, one of my closest friends who, I was recently back in Boston for her wedding. People will have heard an interview that we did together by the time this comes on. She was living downtown on Wall Street. Her husband was a trader on Wall Street, husband at the time. And she was working at a law firm. I think it was in Midtown. And that was one of the scariest days. I could not get a hold of her.
Yeah.
I didn't know where she was for 2 days. It's crazy.
I mean, they put the phone emergency system in the World Trade Center. That was the whole thing. Right? All their mobile phones, reception, everything was all there. So it went up. That was a crazy day.
She was, I think, less than five blocks. And I remember we went down to her place a few weeks after, you know, maybe a month after, 5 weeks, I think it was. And I worked for the airline at the time, and for one of the airlines at the time, and I was able to fly in for free. And the first day I could fly in, which I think was 11 days later, maybe it was 14 days later, but I think it was 11 days later, I flew in because I was like, F them. That's why, right. And I saw the pile and I could smell it. It was
really bad. Smell. Oh, people forget really the smell bad. And the papers flying down for days afterwards, the yellow powder. Oof.
That is, you know, the terrorism and just the whole reminiscing that aside, that is quite the reason to start thinking you need to go somewhere else. Like, I've never spoken to anyone that had an event precipitate them wanting to leave. Like, can you talk a little about that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I had a degree in East Asian studies. I knew I wanted to do something commercial in China at some point in some way. I knew I didn't want to be a teacher. I knew I didn't want to be a politician. I knew I didn't want to do diplomacy. Although actually after that I did, well, we'll get to that in a second. So I decided, you know, it was on the table anyway to move to China in some way. I just didn't know what to do or how to do it. When that happened, and I looked at my expensive apartment and my job that was good, but it was doing international business. And I was like, it's going to be slow for a while. I thought, you know, this is a sign that is a chance to make a choice. And so, yeah, I mean, I really like let my apartment, my lease run up, and I left in, I guess it was December.
Wow.
And I said, like, and I moved to China with no job, with no plan, with no, I mean, I had my New York salary and my annual bonus, which was enough for like 6 months living in China at that point, at the end of 2001.
You were in Shanghai?
In Shanghai, right. And I had studied in the city not far from here, Nanjing, in 98. So I'd sort of come to Shanghai for like beer-soaked weekends, which is what I assumed it was going to be moving here.
It was before the fast train. How long did it take to get here?
Oh, gosh. There was a slow train. Yeah, there was a train, and then there was the slow train.
Was it took the overnight?
Yeah. No, it was like it could be 6 to 8 hours sometimes.
Oh, my God. You could literally make that in like an hour now. Yeah, 55 minutes.
Exactly. 55 minutes. Yeah. And it used to be like 6 to 8 hours.
Wow.
But the problem is I'd always do that with some of the people I was studying with who were German. And so we'd have to buy as much beer as possible. And the toilets on the train were so disgusting that it became an emergency. Like 8 hours of drinking, you can't use the bathroom because it's too gross. It became a whole thing.
You developed you really developed your bladder muscles.
Oh yeah, it was amazing. Getting on the train and like getting the taxi, drive. Yeah. So I moved here. I mean, it was really like, it's funny because I come back. I mentioned earlier, but I you know, for the first 3 or 4 years, I kind of figured New York was home. Most of my college friends had moved to New York. It's kind of like, you know, Yale's only 2 hours away. So everyone was there. And I figured I'd do China for a little bit. And actually, you know, politics kept getting crazy. And I did apply for the State Department at that point. Mm. And I went for all the interviews and I said, okay, yeah, I'm not gonna do it. And they said, okay, well, you know, you're at the final interview stage. Are you gonna be in Washington, D.C.? And I was like, I live in China. But it turned out they scheduled it on my birthday, and I was actually I'm gonna be in America. So I went down to Washington for my State Department to join the diplomatic group, and I passed this whole thing, and I was there already, right? And they asked me a question. They said, okay, can you please describe a circumstance where you've been in a culture other than your own? And I was like, every day? I don't even know. I go from down to Boston. I went to public school. I went to public school through my whole life. Like, I can double Dutch. I can break. Like, what do you want? I was like, I've never been in my culture. I don't even know what that means anymore. Plus, I live in China. Yeah. And then all these people had very immediate answers for it. I was like, and I looked around. I was like, how do you people answer this question? And they're like, tell me, you know, I once went to a Central American food festival. I'm like, once? Like, that's like every day in New York, right? So that's when I realized it wasn't really for me. There was something about the diplomatic corps I couldn't quite get into. And so then I sort of realized I was going to be here for a while.
Huh. That's so interesting you say that. You know, I live in Beijing, so there's a lot of diplomats. It's, you know, all the embassies are there. And actually, I lived in one of the embassy districts for the first 7.5 years I was in the city. I lived on the same block, which is adjacent to the Canadian embassy, Australian embassy, all these embassies. And that foreign service community is quite a bubble. Like, it's really – because most of the guys and girls, they rotate. They do 2 or 3 year rotations. And a bunch of them – you know, some of them are trying to get China on the resume. Some of them, China is the step to something else. I had actually a pretty good friend for a little while who had planned, oh, I want to be like foreign minister one day, so I'm doing the China thing. And she was super young when she got in the foreign. She's one of the youngest people ever to get in the foreign service, and she got China really early. And she kind of excelled at one point, I think by default, because she was in like the cultural section. But just the way the embassy was organized, she was number three at the embassy.
For the U.S.?
No. Okay. This is a different country. Okay. Different country.
We're a big country.
No. Okay. This is actually a big country, but it's not the U.S. Yeah. I don't want to say I don't want to call her out. But she was number three at the embassy. And she was 28, maybe? Because I think she had joined at 17 because she graduated really early. And she was able to do like half time while she was at university. It was this weird thing because she was so smart. And at 28, she was like number three. And then it didn't work out. Like, I think she did go back for a little while, but it didn't work out because she got married and pregnant. And not that that's a detour, but her priority shifted, right? But other than that one person, I've never been able to get really close with anyone in the Foreign Service because it's a very insular community. And I got to say, especially the Americans, my interactions with them, they are not – very friendly. They are advised, I've been told, to stay close to the embassy. Don't go to a lot of places. I've only run into a couple of Marines, and they were nice, but they were pretty douchey.
I mean, I had that. I've had similar experiences. When I finished my interview process, and they said, "Okay, do you have any questions for us?" And you know, I'd gone through all the hoops. So this was like, you're officially going to join and be. And I said, yeah, my question would be, I speak Chinese. I've had 15 years of Chinese in 2003 or 4 at that point. Lived in China for 3 years. What would a career path look like for me? And they said, well, we definitely wouldn't have you in China. We would probably start you in maybe South America or maybe the French speaking Africa. And I was like, why?
Yeah.
What is that? They said, well, you know, we have a sort of belief in not going local. We don't want to have, I could not be less local Chinese, but realizing, you know, it's a model built for a certain time period. And I sort of realized, you know, as an American who has some sort of sense of obligation to my country and also enjoys my life in China and gets to, so there's probably other ways to support American values.
Yeah.
Especially the ones I care about, the ones I don't care about. Back to douchey. I'm not worried about that. Right? Yeah. That's not my job.
So you've been in China then since 2002, maybe?
Yeah, the end of 2001.
End of 2001, 2002. Okay. And what have you been doing since you've been here? I'm not looking for your CV, but I'm just kind of like, how have you been engaging in China, like subsisting?
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know, the first couple months, I lived off my New York salary, and then I realized it was probably time to get a job. And so I did that. I actually threw like a friend from Boston his boyfriend was hired by a German company and was looking for people in China. And so I got hired. And so I worked for a German company for a couple of years. And I'm not cut out for working in a German company. This is a big engineering company. And this is just not my style. Plus meetings were like people speaking Shanghainese to people speaking German. And no, I was like, hey, how about English and Chinese? Like, let's make it simpler on everybody, right? And then I sort of realized I thought about going home for more graduate education. I got a call from one of my agencies who said, research agency, and said, hey, heard you're leaving. We'd love you to come and work for us as a consumer researcher. So I spent about 8 or 9 years sort of running a qualitative research agency company here doing consumer insight. So that meant I worked with
during the rise of, e-commerce and consumer. Wow.
Everything. I mean, like, wow. I worked with beverage makers. I worked with personal care companies, with luxury companies, with auction houses, with car companies, with mobile phone companies, just to understand the China market. And so it was like every day.
While the market's actually trying to understand itself.
So we had like, you know, big beverage makers saying, we want to understand milk. How does milk work in China? I remember one of these, you know, massive personal care companies saying, we want to understand how Chinese people wash their hands. Like, what does hygiene mean? And you realize there's this kind of accumulation of knowledge in developed countries that doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in the corporate system.
Right.
And once they have it, they don't need to redo that research. So it was like the first time they really wanted to understand disinfection and hand washing. For, you know, a major market. And so it's super cool.
That is, I love those stories. I know some of them. I know, like, when, Nair. I know the story about Nair. When they came in here, they had to sell Chinese women on the idea of removing hair. Had a completely different context here. They had to create the demand in the market for it, which is fascinating. Starbucks coming in here. It's like that is textbook 101, how to succeed in China is what Starbucks did. Like I have this thing I do.
That's a great strategy they had.
Well, actually, it's funny. I have when I've done presentations on PR and marketing, just PR marketing 101 I've given to startups, and because it's what I do. And one of the things I will ask them is, hey, everyone, what does Starbucks sell? And people will say, you know, oh, coffee and tea and pastries and whatever. And I will say, okay, you're all right and you're all wrong. Starbucks sells Starbucks. You know, and it's and I love that about China is that you can sell anything here. You just have to understand the market. It's kind of understanding your own product from the inside out. You got to understand why people would want to buy what you're selling, and it's going to be different from where you've come from. I love that.
I mean, I had this challenge. I was doing a project, and so I made a joke earlier, you know, that I'm definitely not the person responsible for Starbucks strategy, but I did work with them, and I was on a panel at something, and someone said, you know, but Chinese people don't drink coffee. I looked at it and said, do you think Chinese people don't sit around and gossip all day? Is that not something you think you can imagine them doing? Because that's what people do at Starbucks. You don't think someone needs to like take a break from work with their like colleague and just like have a quick conversation? That's what they're talking about here. The coffee is irrelevant. And then Starbucks did build a coffee culture. But the way people thought about it was just so literal. I mean, you know, although that being said, one thing I would note is they haven't really made a huge success with tea here.
Yes.
Their tea business, they can't quite. I mean, even they did foreign tea and stuff, that works better, but people just don't really need to go to Starbucks for tea.
Well, I think that's the flip side of their success, which is that if you're so successful at selling yourself as a brand that is success, that is affluence, it almost doesn't matter what you're selling. And once you start selling the one thing that you came in on, no one really gives a crap. Right. You know, they really care about, you got to kind of ride that horse. You've created what you are. You got to go with that. You can't change.
Yeah, right. It's a good point. I mean, I do think one of the brands that I've seen change the most, and I could talk about brands forever.
Yeah.
But one of the brands that's the most amazing to watch has been KFC here. I mean, they came in and back 10, 15 years ago, they realized, I mean, they sold fried chicken so well here. And they're like, it's a killer business. They destroyed McDonald's. I mean, they just like blew them out of the water because people fundamentally don't love beef that much.
Yeah, KFC's everywhere here.
And it's super premium, right? Yeah. So like, actually KFC for years, I mean, it must be almost 6 or 7 years, has been bigger in China than the US. They do all their annual meetings here. Their leadership is here. The US for them is just not really it's not a premium place. It's not a big growth, not a high profit. It's just kind of a mess. But here it's really strong and good. And their menu now is like 80% Chinese food. Right, and they sell it with fried chicken. Right? They sell fried chicken, and then they have lots and lots of congees and rices and noodles and stuff like that. It's great.
Yeah. Well, you know, I very rarely get bogged down in what people do and their professional expertise, just because it's not the focus of the show. But what's interesting about talking about these things with you is because you came here at such a time where the country itself was literally figuring all this stuff out. The growth of consumerism here. So as a foreigner, as a migrant who was coming here from someone else, did you see yourself as kind of an explorer, or were you just trying to work just trying to find a job and work?
No, I mean, really it was because the thing about it was China was changing so quickly at that point. And it has slowed. It's slowed because it's just done that phase.
Right.
That happened. You don't need to do that twice. But it was that everyone is a migrant. I mean, even older Chinese people, my clients, right? People who are 35, the China they were looking at was so far from what they had grown up in 15 years ago or 20 years previous. So in 2005, if you're a 30-year-old, right? You were born in 1975. You grew up in a completely different China than the kids you're dealing with. If you're selling soda or whatever it is.
So, I had I just bust in that resonates with me because some of my colleagues on Migration Media, we did a forum at the U.S. Embassy a couple months ago. And one of the questions at the end, someone was asking during our Q&A, you know, what are your thoughts about China as a migrant? You know, that was kind of the point of our discussion. He kind of asked point blank. And I said, you know, one of the things I've learned about here is we have a real affinity. Like as an American, as a foreigner coming to China, I'm a migrant, but this is a country of migrants. Yeah. Everyone is from, I asked the people, can you all raise your hands if you are Lao Beijingren? You are originally from Beijing. Maybe a third of the room raised their hand, which is actually kind of representative. It's about a third of Beijing, 22 million people that actually is from the city. Most of them are from somewhere else. It's a real migrant culture here, which is fascinating.
I think not only physical migrant, but also just in terms of like the culture has shifted so much, right? Yeah. And so there's a sort of, it's funny now in 2019, you have people starting to talk about traditional Chinese values.
Yeah.
That, we didn't hear that for 20 years. That was not a thing. And now it's like now tradition is a thing, which is, it's the new thing. Tradition is the new
retro,
thing.
It's retro, man.
Yeah, tradition is the new trend. It's hysterical. I think that there's that. I actually got a funny call today sitting in my office, because you forget. I've been here a long time. Everyone sort of knows my situation. I stopped taking taxis because I was just too tired of answering the same questions every day. Imagine 20 years of the same three or four questions, which is like – commenting, your Chinese is so good. Where are you from? How much do you make? Are you married? Is your wife Chinese? And it's like, this is, how many times am I going to have this conversation?
I just say, Tibu Dong, what the Dong is Shibu Hao.
Yeah. That's probably smarter. But I forgot. I got a call today from one of my colleagues who said, we have a government emergency. I was like, why is this coming to me? I have nothing to do with the government. And he said, we need a foreigner who speaks Chinese on tape to wishing our local district government a happy new year.
Oh my God.
I was like, why? Why me, right? And they're like, you're white. You're going on camera right now.
They need the white face.
Yeah. And I speak Chinese. So I got out there and wish everyone health and happiness. Mm. And it's okay. We're going to mash it up with all the other companies here. But every now and then you have this moment of like, whoa, I'm a foreigner.
Yeah.
But other than that,
being in China, and I actually spoke with this with a previous guest that she's an ABC. And for her, there is a limit. Even though she is ethnically Chinese and she speaks some Chinese, but it's broken. But even for her, there is a ceiling. If you're not from here, you're never from here. Like in New England, we have the saying, if your grandfather's not from here, you're not from here. Right. They really mean that here.
Yeah, sure. I think there's a sense of – that's why I live in Shanghai, right? There's a sense of some parts of being in other parts of China, especially Beijing for me. I really have the sense of being like a guest at someone's house for dinner. Mm-hmm. So people are nice to you. They're polite. But like you can't really go rummaging around in the cabinets, and you certainly can't put on your like eating pants. You have to be a little bit proper.
Does that make you feel – does that give you a sense of – not frustration, but like that there is a finality to this. Like this is not a place you can ever be fully.
I think
you've invested all this time and effort and emotional energy, and you've devoted a good almost half of your life at this point. Does that kind of give you a sense of, I don't know, what does it give you a sense of?
Normally it feels quite stable. I guess some political stuff does make you wonder. Like when people ask me, oh, so do you have like a citizenship, dual citizenship? I'm like, that's not a thing. That's not really a process for that. You're mm-hmm. always a visitor, right? And, business people can get a 10-year visa. But I, as a worker here, I have a 1-year visa every year. I have to renew it. And any year I miss my appointment, whatever, I'm out. And it's definitely a concern. It is a consideration on the sort of like structural political level, but on the personal level, I think Shanghai was built as a city with foreigners. Mm. It was not just...
So different.
And it's quite different from Beijing. So Shanghai, I always remind people, like, HSBC is the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, right? Like, it is... This stuff came from Shanghai. It's not... The global institutions came from here. And Shanghai was built by people who moved out of their hometowns to start this new city.
Yeah.
So I think that it does feel in its bones. Like, when I see an older person, like 80 years old, more than half the time, they're just super happy to see me and say hello in English because they learned it in school, right? They learned it in the 40s. And then now politics changed for a couple of years. Now it's back.
Yeah.
And they're just really happy. Like, it makes them feel like they're back in the good neighborhood because they have foreigners again, right?
Wow. Yeah. I never thought of it like that because I guess my exposure in Beijing is just very different. They kind of tolerate foreigners.
No, it's different here. I mean, definitely Shanghai. And it's because Shanghai needs people themselves. They are outward facing.
Oh, that's very true. I flippantly will say, and I've said this in a previous discussion, that, you know, Shanghai is almost not even a Chinese city. It's basically a global city in China. It's almost like New York is an American city, but it's really a global city in America. I don't mean that it's not a Chinese city. I mean, it's a global city that's in China. London is a global city that's in England.
I mean, we've been working on these phrases for years, right? But we used to say, Shanghai turns Chinese into foreigners and Beijing turns foreigners into Chinese. Which way do you want to go?
That actually is very true. I had a buddy of mine who does he recruits foreign talent for Chinese companies, and he's told me flat out, I can't recruit out of Shanghai.
Yeah.
Because the foreigners don't speak Chinese. It's the Chinese don't speak Chinese. You just can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, I used to say, and I got in real trouble for this recently from my colleague who runs the marketing for Shanghai. I used to say Shanghai is Beijing's wife.
No.
Like, it's a lot prettier. It's dressed up. It flirts with all the other ones. It has nice jewels. At the end of the day, in a traditional family, though, like, he's Beijing holding the wallet.
It, yeah.
And, like, you got to have
some patriarchal respect. Society. It is, yeah. The husband is running things.
Correct.
Yeah.
By the way, he looks a mess. He's in his sweatpants, but there it is. That's what you got to do.
That's actually a great analogy.
Yeah.
So you've been here for 18 years, you said?
Yeah.
You've been here for 18 years. You've devoted most of your life to learn and speak and live in Chinese culture in some way. What's down the road for you?
You know, after 15 years or 14 years here of working for a research company that was really China, I mean, really all day, every day was China stuff. It started in Shanghai. It was a local company. We eventually sold to a global group.
As one does.
Then I worked for a design company based out of San Francisco. But I sort of ran out of steam, and I thought, I don't really know why to be here. It's tiring. And I didn't know how to sort of make progress. So I joined a big company, a big American company where I work now.
Wait, this is an American company?
Yeah, you're sitting in an American company. Yeah, exactly. So I realized that it was time to go home. And so I joined the company and said, I don't want to join as a foreign, as an expat, as a China person. I said, you know, my Chinese is very good. My English is even better. Like, I really do speak English, right?
Wow.
Like, I can write about Chinese culture and stuff and kids, pop culture, hip hop, graffiti, whatever. But I can also do that about American, right? And I wanted to start being global. So I joined and said, you know, give me 2 to 3 years and I want to go back to the West Coast. And then I said, you know, when politics gets normal, I'll go back. And then again, here I am. Like, they're asking me, do you want to go back now? And I'm thinking, like, I mean, the opportunity and what's happening in my space is really big here. So I think I'll probably, I might in the next sort of 2 to 3 years, or maybe even 1 year, face a choice of maybe going to maybe Europe or here. I'm not sure about going back to the US. It's just hard because most of my American community haven't really left America much. Whereas whether it's European or Asian, certainly, like my friends in Hong Kong and Singapore, most of them by definition have traveled the world because they're not at home. So it's kind of like an expat kind of feeling, and it's harder to find in America.
It's interesting. I think you're the first person I've spoken to who's kind of on the, let's call it the downward slope of the migration bell curve. Mm-hmm. Not that it downward doesn't mean it's not pejorative, but it's kind of like it sounds like your trajectory was outward facing, even if it's just because you wanted to not take Latin,
right.
You were outward facing. And then eventually it turned into, I'm actually now out, been doing it. And now there's this shift that's happened. And now you're thinking about a reentry plan. Maybe you don't have the details figured out. Maybe you don't know if it's going to be next year or in 5 years, but you've got some kind of plan you're thinking about or formulating in the back of your brain. I've actually, the first person I've spoken to is kind of in that way. The other people I've spoken to are thinking about either we're going to be overseas for the foreseeable future. Like my wife and I, we're at the other end of the curve. It's funny. I've been out for 10 years, but my wife and I, we're just kind of entering this new phase where I almost feel like we're starting anew. Like she's got her career. I'm on this new path and we don't know what the future holds, but we're kind of on the upslope right now. Like, where are we going next? And are we staying here? What's the next step? And it's going to be out here somewhere. And the older people I've talked about are the people in a different phase of life, let's say. A lot of them are thinking about, well, how do I go where I want to go? You know, none of them are talking about going, quote, back. You know what I mean? It's interesting. I'm not knocking it. It's just fascinating.
No, I mean, I think, you know, there's...
That might be harder than you think. I mean, going back might be almost like going out again.
You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who'd been here for maybe 12 years, and I asked him, I said, he moved to San Francisco, and I said, tell me, what's it like? Like, what's it like over there to really live there? Like, I visit all the time, but like, what's it like? And he was like, bro, there's so much time spent doing errands. He's like, you don't get it. He's like, I spent all day like waiting for a delivery man. Then I have to like go here. But he's like, and then I have to like pull out my credit card.
I know.
And I have to sign documents. He's like, what is going on, people? Like, use your mobile phone for everything. Like, and he's like, just everything is slower and less efficient.
I gotta say, it's, we did this trip back to the US, and I have to say, whenever I go back, it feels like going backwards like 10, 15 years. And I'm like, how do people live this way?
Yeah.
Like, how do you, you know, I can't just take the train everywhere. I can't just whip out and call a Didi and it's not really cheap. And, right. You know, I got to tip people. And,
yeah, you got to calculate a tip. Like, are you joking me?
And I can't just pay with my phone.
Right, right. Like, actually, I was in even Hong Kong, which is a very modern city, but it's on payments a little behind. I went to Hong Kong a couple of weeks ago. I forgot my wallet. I don't carry a wallet anymore.
Yeah.
What the hell do I use a wallet for?
Yeah.
I used my mobile phone. I got to Hong Kong and I literally could not pay the taxi. And I had to, like, call a friend and have my friend bring me cash. I was thinking, like, this is awkward. This is the kind of time travel I'm not interested in.
Yeah. And that sounds like a dig on America. I don't think it's so much a dig as it's just a recognition that the idea of, quote, cultural differences in an age of a global interconnected economy has more manifestations. So, like, you don't just have a cultural difference in terms of interpersonal relationships. There are cultural differences in the way we interface with just everyday stuff. Yeah. Phones, technology, consumerism, like they do it. Your culture breeds a different way of doing things. And when you go from place to place, it hits you in the fucking face, man.
Yeah, right. Well, and it's not even just material things, right? There are things, like one of the things that I go home and I get really stressed out about and then kind of like, I react to it is just feeling exhausted by the amount of media you're exposed to. Mm. And I realize part of that's because I just zone out with Chinese media. I read Chinese, okay, but I don't have to read it. So I can stare at a wall of newspapers and not get a thing and walk away feeling totally light, like nothing happened today.
That is very true.
I can't
true.
Get that in America.
That is very it. True. I have to make an affirmative decision to be exposed to Western media here. Like if I don't make a point to go check my thing, it's not on TVs. It's not radiating from anywhere. It's just... Right. I can live in my bubble.
So if you go to like a U.S. domestic airport, right, when they're always playing the news.
Oh,
and
my
I'm
God.
Like, please turn it off. Yes. I don't want this like passive news coming at me. I don't want to
do that. It's so funny you say that because when we came back to China on our last trip, we're sitting in the waiting area, two different airports, and it's like, oh, my God, it's always on.
Yeah. It's agitating. It's just annoying.
Yeah.
And here, like, the same thing might be happening here, but I've never noticed. I just zone out, right? Like, yeah. I don't need to listen.
I almost look at it. I'm kind of like, oh, what are they showing pictures of? Like, what are the Chinese people learning about today?
Yeah, exactly. Right. What's happening in the Chinese world? Meanwhile, it's like picture of American politicians. And I'm like, I don't know who that is. I don't know. Yeah. So I definitely think that some of those things would be a hard reentry. I'm thinking maybe Europe is the easy way to enter first, but who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. So I don't want to take up too much more of your time. You've been very generous. Now you're a very busy, big, powerful, important person at this international conglomerate that you are employed at as a foreigner, not a Chinese person. One thing I do want to finish up on, though, is this idea of identity, which is we've kind of touched around it a little bit. When you said to me that you wanted to be hired as a foreigner and like, cause you speak English too, do you feel like that was a reaction to something? Or was that like you mentioned being sick of talking to the taxi drivers. Is that like a symptom of that? Like you don't want to be the guy who's the China expert anymore? Like what's that? Like, how did that happen? Like, what's that all about? How did you go from, I want to learn about Chinese and East Asian studies. I want to be that expert to now I don't want to be that anymore. Like, that's not who I am.
Yeah. No, it's an astute question. I think, after years being here, the thing is China was then and is still probably the most commercially valuable place to have experience. But that doesn't necessarily mean you yourself are getting much out of it. It means your company's getting a lot out of it. And the growth, it can be exhausting to always do things for the first time, as to never have someone above you who really knows what they're doing or has seen it before for the local market. And that's why I moved into a big company, a successful company.
Trailblazers die. Those guys who try to go across Antarctica, they die.
They die, right. Yeah. Or they certainly get burned out. And then when they go home, they just want to sit for a while. Right? and I think that what happened for me was my interest was never explicitly or purely in China only. It was, I was kind of shocked in high school, for instance. First of all, it was in not Latin, but I was shocked that like our world history didn't have any Chinese history. I look at a map and I'm like, am I the only one who's looking at the same map? Like I'm looking at population. And so a lot of it is just like to kind of fill in the blanks, right? And if you look at any business now, depending on the industry, but some are sort of protected from being in China. But generally speaking, it's the world's second largest economy. And that doesn't mean – it means not that to separate yourself into that, but to be part of the world, you should know and be able to be competent in what's happening in China. And I kind of hit that period in my career when I was thinking – my value to the China org is going to always remain high, but my value to the global org, because of my China knowledge, is even higher. And so that's just kind of a little bit of thinking about. And that's not just in one role, but that's generally speaking, like having international experience makes you better at being general or global. It's not only to go there, right? It's to, and that means even things like who you work with and like the experience in my China office. I sit with, you know, people on my team from Italy, from England, from Brazil, from Japan, from Korea, from China. That's normal. I don't think you get that same thing at global headquarters as much.
Yeah. So that shift in identity then is more a function of kind of just a natural career progression than any kind of internal processes?
I think it's more of like being, this is a super pretentious thing to say, but I don't know where to say it, which is kind of feeling like you're global. Like, you know, like when I go on Facebook, which I go on, by the way, I have a VPN. I go on Facebook and I put in like, hey, I'm going to be visiting Turkey. Like the next day I have 10 messages from friends from college or whatever. Like, oh, great. Like I live here now. I know I'm Turkish. Right. And like you, that global nature, you can't be in one country forever.
You don't need to be a migrant to be global anymore. You've established your sense of, or you've validated or affirmed or developed your sense of, I'm a global person. Yeah. It no longer requires you being here to do that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And also, even if you're here, even if I were in America,
you'd still be that person.
Yeah, so your friends, and actually, so that's why the question of like, which is home? I can say Shanghai, but I could just as easily say San Francisco, New York, London, you know, frankly, Istanbul, right? I mean, like those are places that there's a lot of global people hanging out.
This has challenged one of my notions. One of the kind of driving reasons that I did the podcast was to figure out what is the migration experience. And what you're saying is that the migration experience, that implies that there's an end to it, where the act of migrating could be just the first step in a transformation, not a journey.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, this is theoretical because I still live here. So, right. I could be wrong.
That's true. But, I mean, you might end up back in America and say, what the hell have I done?
My bounce rate of like 30 seconds. And no, it's
but it's a good possible. Theory. It's sound theory. Yeah. And, you know, this is actually a good place to kind of end it because I kind of want to have you back when you do that. And we'll have that conversation and we'll see if you were right or wrong and if your life is a disaster.
Yeah, good. If it's a disaster, I'm sure I'll come with stories for you.
Well, PG Black, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you taking the
Great
time.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. I certainly learned a lot in that conversation. I hope you guys did too. Thanks again to PT for taking time out of his busy schedule to sit down with me. If you have any questions or comments about this interview, or if you have some topic suggestions or interview suggestions, please reach out. I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me at email at mike.shaw@migrationmedia.net. Of course, I'm also on Twitter at ZAX2000. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.